the podcast from Belmont Chapel in Exeter, sharing the story, living the life. For more information, go to belmontchapel.org.uk.
Good evening, it's great to see you all. I have a question for you to start. Have you ever met someone but not realised their significance? I don't know if you recognise this man. I definitely didn't before I was preparing for this. But at 7:51 a.m. on Friday, the 12th of January 2007, this man, the critically acclaimed virtuoso Joshua Bell, began playing in a metro station in Washington, D.C. In his 43-minute performance, he played six of the most technically demanding pieces ever written on a violin which had cost him $3.5 million. 1,027 people walked past during that performance, and only seven stopped to listen. And of those seven, only one recognized who he was. Now, the full article describing that experiment is still available on the Washington Post website. It's under the headline, Pearls Before Breakfast, and it's definitely worth a read. And that's coming from someone who doesn't enjoy reading. So, have you ever met someone but not realized their significance? It's been really helpful, actually, Rosie's poem. Kind of stolen the first bit of my sermon. But I want you to try and picture the scene. So 6 days have passed since the incident at Caesarea Philippi, which Simon looked at last week, where Peter stands up and says, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." So Peter's certainly grasped the significance of Jesus. But what about the others? Do the others know who he is, what he's talking about? Verse 1, we read, after 6 days, Jesus took with him Peter and James and John, his brother, and led them up a high mountain by themselves. So if you could picture yourself as a Peter or a James and a John, maybe close your eyes if that's helpful. Scholars seem to think that this mountain that they're talking about is Mount Hermon. It's just north of Israel. And Mount Hermon is 2,814 meters, or 9,232 feet, whereas Caesarea Philippi sits all the way down at 350 meters, or 1,150 feet. So you've made quite a climb at some point in the last 6 days. So well done. So let's carry on reading. He was transfigured before them, and his face shone like the sun. His clothes became white as light, and behold, there appeared to them Moses and Elijah talking with him. Are you still there? Are you still visualizing it, or did it just get really weird? Suddenly it became words on a page. That's not what it was for them. So take a minute and make sure you can sit there with them. This man's been your teacher for the past 2.5, maybe the best part of 3 years. He's a good friend. You know him. You've spoken with him. You've seen him do inexplicable things and speak of outrageous love and mercy. And this man stands before you now, with his face shining so bright you can barely look at it. And then these other two men appear, whom you've never seen before, but you recognize immediately are Moses and Elijah. Two massive figures from the Old Testament, from scriptures that you've been studying since you were children. And they're here now in your presence. Are you starting to understand how it might have felt? Then Peter, whoever's Peter out there, you stand up and you say, "Lord, it's good that we're here. If you wish, we can make three tents here, one for you, one for Moses, one for Elijah." But while you're still speaking, a bright cloud appears and overshadows you, and a voice says, "This is my beloved Son, with whom I am well pleased. Listen to him." What do you find yourself doing? What can you do? We read that these three men, when they heard this, they fell on their faces and were terrified. But Jesus came to them and touched them, saying, "Rise and have no fear." And when they lifted up their eyes, they saw no one but Jesus only. So hopefully you're getting a sense of how the disciples have felt here. The word in the ESV is terror. It's quite descriptive. In the Amplified Version, it says, "seized with alarm and struck with fear." And the Greek word is the same word we get phobia from. So it's quite a distinct and strong emotion. And this word also appears in the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Old Testament, which was probably being used in Jesus' time. And it's in passages like Isaiah 8:13, which describes a proper approach to God. I think we can often be over-familiar in the way that we approach this God. We can rely so heavily on love and mercy that we forget how awesome and how powerful he is. Perhaps it is worth considering that when God speaks, often the right place to be is on your knees. So let's take a look at the event itself. We've got Jesus and Moses and Elijah. We also have Peter and a seemingly random comment and a voice from a bright cloud who we are to take as God the Father. And we also have James and John, who are bystanders for the first part of our reading. Let's start with Moses. Moses is the one through whom the law was given. And Moses has a lot of stories associated with him. He was born in a time of oppression and hardship. In his infancy, God acted powerfully to save him from a tyrannical king. He was sent by God to be God's mouthpiece, and he acts to rescue Israel. And after the salvation is achieved by God, he gives his law through Moses. That's why we see Moses here. He represents the law. But it's more than just law. The law that God gave through Moses is more than just a set of rules that we need to follow. It shows us his nature, his high moral standards, yes. But it also shows his heart for the poor, his demand for justice, his care for the rights of individuals, no matter what their social standing is. His concern for health and cleanliness, for enough time in the day to relax and enjoy life, and even festivals that were to be observed. The law didn't let poverty cross generations, and it wouldn't allow slavery to last a lifetime. The law was a glimmer of life, and life in all its fullness. It's also important to note that the law never saved anyone. It wasn't living by the book to earn salvation. God saved his people from Israel, and then he gave them the law. Salvation was, is, and always will be an act of God. We don't earn it. We certainly don't deserve it. And yet it's freely given from the riches of his grace. And the proper response is gratitude. And gratitude is realized in obedience. Our verse for the year, I don't know if you've got one of these on. Wave it at me. You're all there. Well, we've got a couple still. Are there more available? No, we've run out, I'm afraid. So maybe you can find the one that you've got. Our verse for the year is, "Obey everything that I have commanded you." Where do we find it in the story? It comes after the death and resurrection of Jesus. It comes after God's saving work. So if Moses represents the law, what's Elijah here for? Elijah represents the prophets. The prophets were the voice of God. pointing the people, mostly the kings, but the people as well, back to the law, back to the nature and character of God. They were a continual reminder of God's presence with his people and his heart for his people. And they brought God's message, not just in words, but also in vivid pictures. If we consider prophets like Hosea, he obeyed God and married a prostitute and suffered the humiliation and the pain as she chased after other men, just to depict how incredibly, horrifically Israel was treating their God. So Elijah is considered one of, if not the greatest prophet of the Old Testament. And through him, God spoke to King Ahab, and he stopped the rain for 3 years. But he provided for a widow and for her son, and when her son died, he raised him from the dead. Now we'll come back to Elijah in a few minutes. With these things in mind, let's look at Jesus now. I don't think it's too bold a claim to say that this entire gospel is about Jesus. So the question we've got to ask ourselves is, what do Moses and Elijah at this moment tell us about Jesus? Now, it's a long time since we were in Matthew chapter 5. I think that would be in Follow Me, right back in the first section. But perhaps these words are still familiar to you. This is Jesus speaking. He says, "Do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them." So the presence of Moses and Elijah is deeply symbolic. They're here almost to see their lives' work come to fruition and to witness the heart of God's salvation plan. But there's still more to it. Deuteronomy 17:15 is a passage generally held to be a prophecy about the coming Messiah. That's one who is promised and one who is anointed by God for a particular purpose. And the scholars during the period of time between the Old and New Testament were looking for one specific Messiah who was going to be the fulfillment of several of these prophecies all in one person. Moses says, "The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among you, from your brothers. It is to him you shall listen." So consider for a moment the similarities between Moses and Jesus and their stories. They were both born in a time of oppression. And they were both saved from a tyrant king by an act of God. They were both called to lead and to save a people. And they both reveal the nature of God to humanity. A prophet like me seems like an apt description. Whilst we're at it, let's compare Jesus and Elijah. Both perform miracles with weather. Both perform miracles with food. Both raise the dead. Both appear before kings, and both challenge wrongdoing. I don't know who was Peter in the crowd here, but obviously the thing to do now is build some tents. It's obvious. Now, it seems like a random thing to say, and a lot of scholars do think that Peter's so startled by what's going on that he's just talking nonsense. But I'm not such a fan of that explanation. I think if that was the explanation, Matthew would have said that Peter started talking nonsense. I like the Illustrated Bible Dictionary's suggestion that Peter is trying to make something permanent, a reminder of what's going on here. In a sense, he's trying to take a photograph. And it's something we see a lot in the Old Testament. People building shelters or altars or even just piling stones on top of each other to mark significant moments, significant events, significant places. So although what he's saying isn't ridiculous, he's still got the wrong end of the stick. This wasn't a revelation that was meant to be savored. It was for that moment in time. It was a confirmation of Jesus' purpose, not an occasion to mark with a permanent monument. Perhaps there's an important lesson in that. I don't know if anyone has ever been to one of these big Christian festivals or conferences, but often you can come away with a massive emotional buzz, and you feel filled with all the good intentions and drive to go out and do something about what you heard. But within a week or two, the buzz is just gone, and it's another day. It's like the grace that we receive for our day-to-day lives is somehow different from those mountaintop experiences. And perhaps we need to learn to rely on God where we are and how we are, and not go chasing after the next big experience. Or worse, go back to an old one and find that it's lost the power it had the first time. Behold, it says in my Bible, it's a great word. Behold, a bright cloud overshadowed them, and a voice from the cloud said, "This is my beloved Son, with whom I am well pleased. Listen to him." I think this one's pretty clear. It's the voice of God the Father. It mirrors Old Testament images. At the end of Exodus, we read, God's presence with Israel is signified by a cloud. In particular, if we look at Exodus 40, we see the cloud that rests on the tabernacle, telling them when to stop and just enjoy his presence, and then moving out, showing them where they're going to go next, where their next move is. And God doesn't mince his words. This Jesus is my Son. Do as he says. Simple message. God the Father wants us to be in no doubt what this moment means. This is my Son. Do as he says. But we've definitely heard these words before. At Jesus' baptism in chapter 3, we also read, a voice from heaven said, "This is my beloved Son, with whom I am well pleased." So why the repetition? Well, since then, this Jesus movement has gained momentum and a lot of people. And as Rosie pointed out in her poem, from this moment on, Jesus is looking towards the cross. Everything he does, everything he says, is in light of the fact that just 3 short chapters away, he enters Jerusalem for the last time. This is a moment to step back from the hype and remember who Jesus is and why he's come. So have you ever met someone but not realized their significance? Or if I'm blunt, have you ever met Jesus and not realized his significance? Imagine you're at a posh dinner party or mixer where you're introduced not with just your name, but also some facts about your life. So for me, it'd be, this is Adam. He's a maths graduate. He currently works part-time for the church and part-time in a kitchen. This is Jesus. He's the Son of God, and he suffered and died to save humanity from the result of its own sin. Where does that conversation go? If it goes along the lines of, "Oh, the Son of God, how's that working out for you? Do you see yourself in that role in 5 years' time, or are you looking for a promotion?" Then I've met him, but I've missed his significance. If instead it cuts me to the heart, and the only response I can come up with is, "You did that for me? Why me? I don't deserve that." Then I'd be closer to the mark. If you've been to a Bible-believing church that is true and faithfully preaches the gospel, then I guarantee you have met Jesus. Have you responded? Perhaps you have, but you need to respond again. You just need to sit in the presence of Jesus and remember what he's done and remember who he is. Do make the most of the prayer team who will be at the back of the service, and they'd be delighted to pray with anything that you have on your heart at the moment. We're all right for time. We can do this bit. What about Peter, James, and John? I don't have a blank slide. That's unfortunate. I think they get it. I think they understand his significance. Well, Peter definitely does. Just a chapter ago, he said it. But I think the reason that we can say conclusively they understand that Jesus is the Son of God is the question that they ask afterwards. Because it's a clever question. They say this: then why do the scribes say that first Elijah must come? These men have been students under Jesus' tuition for the best part of 3 years. Just think about that. They are effectively about to complete an undergraduate degree in theology supervised by the Son of God. These aren't just common fishermen anymore. Not that there's anything wrong with fishermen. There's something more to them than that. So it's out with questions that we saw earlier in the Gospels, like, tell us the meaning of the parable, or what is the meaning of the saying? Instead, we're met with this question. I'd be prepared to wager that then is being used as a logical connective rather than to denote passage of time, in which case it must be preceded by a condition. We have an if-then statement. So we know that our then results in a question, but what's the condition? What's the if? If you'll allow me to put words in the mouths of the disciples, see if you agree. If all this that we've just seen means that you're the Messiah, the Christ, the Son of God, the one we've been waiting for, then why do the scribes say that Elijah must come first? To paraphrase Jesus' response, good question, you're right. And he does come, but they didn't recognize him. One of the scriptures that the scribes, who were the academics of the time, got this idea from would have been Malachi 4, the very last chapter in our Old Testament. I'm going to read the last three verses of it for you. Remember the law of my servant Moses that I commanded him at Horeb for all Israel. Behold, I will send you, guess who? Elijah, the prophet, before the great and awesome day of the Lord comes. And he will turn the hearts of fathers to their children and the hearts of children to their fathers, lest I come and strike the land with a decree of utter destruction. Slightly bleak ending. So we see some familiar faces and ideas. Moses and his relation to the law, Elijah and his relation to the prophets. And it adds a little context to what we've seen. These things would have been in the minds of the disciples as they first saw what we've looked at this evening. But it does suggest a more active role for Elijah than just a cameo on the mountainside. But if we look at Jesus' response, it's in verse 11. I'm sorry, I've got a slightly different version here to you. Elijah does come, and he will restore all things. But I tell you that Elijah has already come, and they did not recognize him, but did to him whatever they pleased. So also the Son of Man will certainly suffer at their hands. Then the disciples understood that he was speaking to them of John the Baptist. Note Elijah's role in Jesus' words. It is a work of restoration. In Malachi, we see a community restored where hearts of fathers are turned back to their children and vice versa. Jesus says to them, this work has already been done. Elijah has played his part. And I don't even have to infer that the disciples understood, says it there in black and white. And then he speaks for the second time in this gospel about how he must suffer and die, just as John did at the hands of the same men. This, I think, is, as I've already mentioned, a turning point in the gospel where Jesus sets his sight on the cross in just a few weeks' time. So if you would, cast your mind back to Joshua Bell in the metro station at Washington. In the article describing the experiment, the journalist quotes a curator from the National Gallery. He said, let's say I took one of our more abstract pieces, say an Ellsworth Kelly, that's an Ellsworth Kelly, and removed it from its frame, marched it down the 52 steps that people walk up to get to the National Gallery, past the giant columns, and brought it into a restaurant. This is a $5 million painting. And it's one of those restaurants where there are pictures on the wall that are for sale by some industrious kids from the local school. And if I hang this on the wall with a $150 price tag, no one's going to notice it. An art curator might look up and say, hey, that looks a little like an Ellsworth Kelly. Please could you pass the salt? Now, Jesus was sent to a very humble beginning, to a family that was disgraced by his very arrival. And after a short career of teaching and miracles, he dies a criminal's death. On this mountain, we see Jesus in his frame. We see the Son of Man, the Son of God, in his proper context. Will we join the disciples in reverent worship? Or will it make absolutely no difference to how we live tomorrow? Thank you.